Hi, this is Tamson Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
At Tamson and Dan Read the Paper. It's Sunday, April.
April 6th.
It's April 2nd, yeah. And we have a special guest today, Armand Evers. So who's Armand Evers, Dan?
I've been wondering that a long time. Armand,
too.
Armand Ten's Bar.
He's our favorite bartender.
And it's quite a list of bartenders it is. But in any event, we find ourselves very often Friday evening at Deanna's.
In Lambertville, MJ.
And we sit around the big U-shaped bar tended by Armand, who is quite the personality. So much so that we felt that in exchange for his toning down that personality at the restaurant, we could have him on during the podcast. So here he is.
Thank you very much.
And it's a lovely restaurant.
It is a lovely restaurant.
A grown-up restaurant. Kind of dark and sparkly and beautiful, and we love being there.
But none of that's attributable to Armand, who's not dark or sparkly. Yeah, but he
also works at the Boathouse.
He does.
Which is the most charming.
That's pretty
bar
charming.
In New Jersey. Entirely different from Deanna's.
It is that.
But it's like a private grown-up clubhouse or something.
But he works there because there are only three bartenders in Lambertville, so he has to tend bar at all the other places too. So he's a busy guy.
It's union stuff.
And he's a man of many skills. He goes on and on about his talent splitting wood, which we doubt a little bit, but apparently he's Lincoln-esque in that connection. And we can't list all his talents here or all his interests, but we wanted him today in particular because it's opening day of the baseball season.
It is.
And Armand is a fellow baseball enthusiast, and I say fellow along with Tamsin and myself. but perhaps even more attuned to opening day than Tamsin and myself, because he's attended quite a few opening day games.
I have. I've made a bunch. For a while there, I'm a Phillies fan. We'll start there. And come February, those dog days of February when nothing's going on, snowing outside, look at the schedule, plan out when is opening day. And wherever the Phillies played, that's where I'd go. They're opening in Miami. It's Miami we go. Pittsburgh, Atlanta. Been up to Shea, of course, the old Shea Stadium, which I love. Like the new stadium, but for some reason, I love the old Shea Stadium. Blew off a job interview in Baltimore.
Yeah, well, that's my favorite. Tell that story quickly.
That was great.
I don't believe it.
I had a job interview in Baltimore. I was a young guy, early 20s, suited, tied up and everything, ready to go for this job interview. Got down there early, pick up a paper. It's a Ferris Bueller day out there. 72, 74, not a cloud in the sky. Go get a paper, kill a little time. Big headline, opening day. Easy call to the job interview. Not going to make it. It's off to the old War Memorial Stadium and baseball and hot dogs and peanuts.
See, that's the kind of thing you see in the movies, but you don't really see people in real life who had that experience.
My life is like a movie.
Let's stick with baseball for just a few minutes, if you can. But that's impressive. I mean, it does. There is something special about opening day, the baseball season. And there's something special about baseball, although, you know, it's much debated at this point. It's a little bit out of style. It's not played at the same pace as the other sports.
And granted, it's probably, you know, our generation is different than somebody in their 20s now. It's a different world. I mean, to me, this is Christmas Day. Tomorrow, Monday, no work, no nothing. And it's the beginning of spring. I don't care what the sun, science, or popular belief is. Tomorrow is the first day of spring. So, and soon enough, sleeveless days of June, green grass, violent blooms of flower dresses, and afternoons that make you sleepy.
Well, yeah, and there are people, you know, feel they have to defend baseball. I was picking up something in the journal today. They're waxing poetic about the game.
Yeah.
I think people need to defend baseball.
It's a little slow.
I like baseball.
But it's sort a little
of
slow.
You know, I like to go to baseball games. I like sitting there in the atmosphere,
sure,
you know, with the snacks, etc.
Have time to look at people.
But is there more to it than that?
Well, according to the Wall Street Journal, an article by a fellow named Scott Simon, he says that baseball is the slowest of major American sports, but it can transport us like a fine novel. A great game is like a great book is a world unto itself. It is sympathetic characters and villains. We imagine ourselves performing alongside them in moments of repose and pressure. Baseball's dramas can lift us to the brink of joy or leave us on the edge of tears. Now you're a Phillies fan. So you know about the edge of tears, I would think.
Thank you. Certainly for the last 5 years, yes.
Yeah, look, there's something to that. I mean, you know, it, the basketball we've been watching is thrilling. You know, football is a battle. Mm-hmm. And it's very intense mm-hmm. to me. Baseball is not a battle. Baseball is a struggle, which is a little bit different.
Well, that, and then, I mean, sure, like every sport, different people take different things from it. I think baseball, there's more extremes to it. I mean, like Tamsin was just saying, out enjoying a gorgeous summer night
right.
at a ball game, you might not even be that much into the game itself. But it's just the whole being there and the sounds, the sights and smells, everything. So.
Yeah, no, look, it's a fantastic day, opening day, and we're glad we finally have it. And you were telling us before about the special connection between Percocet and baseball.
Percocet.
I should say that Armand lives in Percocet.
I live in Percocet. That's okay. little town, about 8,500 people. And back in 1920 to 1950, Ray, I think his first name was Ray Hubbard. He was making baseballs. His little company was making baseballs for Spalding. And they said they made millions of them. They had 2,000 people employed. A lot of them just sewing from home, sewing the leathers
baseballs
on baseball.
At home?
Sewing at home.
Sewing
yeah.
baseballs at home.
Yeah, I mean, they
working
had
from home.
And working from home. They had a factory, but then they also people were doing them right at home. And you know, they'd have contests who was the best stitcher and everything.
Really?
But yeah, and basically we got a couple gorgeous little league fields, and it's still a strong tradition.
So
there
were the first telecommuters were the people stitching baseballs.
Yeah,
from
this
home.
Telecommuting's old hat.
Okay, I see. And your Phillies this year, you know, what's your take on the Phillies this year?
Well, okay, you know, they're not going to be great. We all know that. But I'm optimistic. Last year was just a dull, flat year of, yes, we're rebuilding, up-and-comers. This year, I really feel there's going to be a little traction there. So it's rebuilding, and, you know, when it's all said and done, we'll probably be about a 500 team. But it should be an exciting year of 500.
See, the reason I wanted to ask you is this. I don't want to get into the details of the Phillies
yes.
too terribly much, but just... The one thing about baseball opening day is it brings out the optimism in
everybody's
all the fans.
Everybody's in first.
And
yeah, of course.
You couldn't be more wrong about the Phillies.
But it's the optimism. That's the great Phillies, thing about opening day.
I'll give you one statistic about the Phillies, then we'll move on. And that is that the Phillies suffered the greatest negative differential in runs scored in the entire league last year.
What on earth
in
does
runs
that
scored.
Most differential. In other words, the Phillies gave up like 250 more
and
runs than they actually scored.
Oh, okay.
And yeah. that was so that would put them 30th out of 30 teams in the major leagues. So you want to hold on to 500, you do that. But opening day, the power of opening day.
It's the power of opening day. It's like buying that lottery ticket. And you're holding it for a couple days, dreaming about that $300 million winning you're gonna have, and then the letdown the next day.
Okay, all right. Listen, I wish you the best in the Phillies.
Dare to dream.
During the week, Tams and I had the opportunity to go to a play at McCord.
Are you not going to tell us about the Mets?
No,
oh,
yeah. We'll do this in a future.
What are you expecting from the Mets?
The Mets are going to go to the World Series. I mean, I don't want to. I thought it was.
You guys did predict it.
You didn't want to rain on Armand's
yeah.
parade.
Well, already down, thank you.
Exactly. I thought it was poor manners because I've got the top team in the league here.
Oh,
you know, gee, you try to be a nice guy. You
it's
know?
Like Ali leaning over. What's
George
the,
Foreman?
No.
Listen.
Let's thank
that's
you.
The famous
yes,
picture.
Yes,
Ollie
okay.
Gator,
yeah.
Saying, don't get up because otherwise I'm in a bad fight.
Stupid Mets. Right.
In any event, the Mets, that's my prediction. Mets in the World Series, you can hold me to that. And I think they're going to win. Not that that's optimism from opening day. That's just the reality.
okay.
To theater. So,
theater update.
Tams and I had the opportunity to see a play at MacArthur Theater on Wednesday
in
Princeton.
Yeah.
Nice.
And one of the top local theater.
Regional theaters, absolutely.
Regional theaters
absolutely.
In the country. They've gotten awards for that, right? A Tony Award?
They did.
Yeah.
They did. And we saw a production
of the Orient Express.
Murder on the Orient Express.
Murder on the Orient
And
Express.
Fairly described as a new production in the sense that of course, was a famous Agatha Christie book and a movie, but it had never been put into the form of a play. And so now we got to see it in the form of a play.
Yes.
And we should say, first of all, that we saw it in large part because Lisa Walsh, our friend, was involved in doing the scenery in the play.
Yes.
And the scenery was great. And the set is
the
no small
fabulous.
Part of it.
The sets are fabulous and wonderfully crafted by all these artisans, including Lisa. And
right.
it's a great design. It's like actual train cars. You're looking at train cars.
Sure, of course.
Kind of moving back and forth across the stage and really beautifully evokes the period.
Right. And then it really
much more so than the actors evoked
it. All right. Here's the segment. I mean, the truth is it wasn't great. And the question we were asking of why wasn't it great, we all remembered the movie fondly. And the movie was an interesting movie. And how come this didn't seem to come to life so very much? It seemed kind of flat. And there were two. So I looked up the movie, and the first distressing thing was when we're sitting there saying, "What was that movie? Was it 15, 20 years ago?" Okay, it was 40 years ago.
I told you.
What can I say? You're right again.
E.T. was 40. Longer than that.
I was a younger man. Tamsin was 7 years old. And there we found ourselves in the same movie theater together. But what was odd, the reason the movie worked. It's quite clear when you look at the reviews that you pick up then, or you can really have to.
We're just looking at the cast.
But you have to look for. Well, the old reviews said that it was about the cast.
Yeah.
And you look at the cast, and I'll just tell you the cast was Albert Finney from Tom Jones, Lauren Bacall from To Have and Have Not, Martin Balsam from Catch 22, Ingrid Bergman from Casablanca. Sean Connery, of course, James Bond himself.
I see Jacqueline Bisset.
Jacqueline Bisset. Yeah. I knew you wouldn't miss that. From Bullet, John Gielgud from All the Shakespeare. Wendy Hiller from Pygmalion. Anthony Perkins, Tony Perkins from Psycho.
So that's all you need, right?
Vanessa Redgrave. It goes on and on and on. It's the most amazing cast.
It's a mad, 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 mad world of mysteries.
It is like that. It was that was a great comedy that had Buddy Hackett and everybody else back then. But that's what made that so much fun and so interesting to see all these people who are very big.
But this was a good cast. If you looked at their credentials.
But it wasn't fun. It was just goofy. To see Ingrid Bergman play a supporting part. And I'll tell you, by the way, she got an Academy Award for that movie. For a part that was minuscule.
But in a movie, it's more like you can be in the train car with the people.
Right.
This, we're looking at them from such a distance. It wasn't quite the same.
Right, it's true. But the set was great. Although I will add one point to the set, which I was reminded of a great quote. That's been attributed to Richard Rodgers but others too. It's that no one leaves the theater humming the scenery. And what Richard Rodgers meant when he said that was he has to write the songs for it to be a success. And in a regular play, there has to be something to the play. So notwithstanding the scenery was great, at least it did a great job, it was just okay. But we recommend McCarter Theater. We had a lovely time. And there was a nice little restaurant just across the way.
The Dinky. They took the old train station and made it into a bar.
So it's a venue, and it's worth checking out on a regular basis.
Hey, right. Just real quick, you were just talking about the movie, and it's all filmed in the train car. I wonder if it was by accident or not. It almost makes it confining and constricting and builds the tension versus a play.
Oh, that's possible.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You're there, and it's like, ooh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, I don't know.
That could be.
Okay, so we have to learn how to hum scenery.
Apparently.
All right. So I just got a quick little thing. I was glancing at the business section and met a new and interesting person, Jesse Woolley Wilson, who is the CEO of Dreambox Learning, a provider of online math education software for children. She has an interesting personal story, but I won't go into that now. I just was, the title of the article is Be Soft on People, Tough on Ideas. And she's a believer in sort of encouraging benevolent friction in the company, that people should feel free to strongly disagree, strongly defend ideas. She thinks friction is all right. And she said, often people are nervous about that. They don't want to disagree with anybody. But she likes to point out, I would explain, she says, that if you don't have pressure on the carbon, you never get to the diamond.
Yeah, well, it's something that
that struck me as good advice. Yeah. She's an interesting person. Jesse Woolley Wilson. Google that article.
Well, how that leads us to the question, how much of benevolent friction do you think is the right level at the bar?
Well, I do still work there, so
I don't mean among the staff.
I'm a big believer in that, because I mean, if you have a room full of sheep that are pursuing a bad idea and nobody's disagreeing, it's just a matter of time. It's inevitable.
But how about disagreements among the customers?
Oh, I disagree. I'm because I believe in the honesty. You know, if you're just a yes man, it's like, okay, well.
No, but I did. Nice enough, I will tell you. I remember I was on a date at Princeton in my freshman year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we went out with some other people. And, you know, on the way we're talking about something in, you know, one of the, you know, English classes, you know, different interpretations. And when we got back, my date said to me, I wish you wouldn't do that. From now on, please don't disagree. Ooh. With my friends when we go out. Wow. And so that was anti-benevolent French.
Yeah. So just so we're clear, I was not the guy on the date.
No.
And our entire relationship, in fact, based on benevolent friction.
Yes.
Or usually often benevolent.
Yes. Once in a while,
benevolent. On average, yes. All right, so.
And there have been a lot of diamonds.
There's a lot of, we're making diamonds like nobody's business. We're working on right now. The basketball last. We're not going to dwell on basketball because by the time you hear this, the tournament will be over. But one interesting story is that North Carolina has made its way into the final. And North Carolina was in the final last year. And some of you may remember they played Villanova and were ahead with just seconds to go. And Villanova benefited from a long shot from a player named
Chris Jenkins.
There you go.
Yeah.
Hit the winning shot, and Villanova became the winner. And the theme that you keep hearing from North Carolina this year is redemption. They're trying to redeem themselves from last year. Well, the funny thing about it is that Chris Jenkins has a brother of the North Carolina team. And so, you know, they're close. So a few weeks after that game and that great loss by North Carolina, Chris Jenkins contacts his brother, whose name's Nate Britt. He says, Nate, listen, I understand you guys work out on a regular basis in the spring. Can I join your pickup games? And the word gets back to the coach at North Carolina, and the first reaction is, that's the last guy we want to see in a North Carolina campus, this guy Chris Jenkins. And someone
dashed our dreams. Dashed our dreams.
Then someone says, wait a minute, think about this. I mean, we want to sort of motivate the team for next year. Tell them they have to redeem themselves. What better way than be constantly reminded by the presence of Chris Jenkins on campus? And they say, okay, fine, have him come by. Well, he comes by on a regular basis. Redemption's the theme. And sure enough, it's carried them again to the final. Villanova was knocked out 3 weeks ago. And who's sitting two rows behind the Carolina bench in all these games? Nate Britt's brother. Chris Jenkins.
Because he has nothing to do.
Because he's got nothing to do.
Because they're out of the...
So, you know, we credit North Carolina for making the most of that and then getting a supporter in the oddest possible way. So maybe they'll succeed. They play Gonzaga on Monday. My guess, for what it's worth, is Gonzaga will probably handle them, but maybe they'll be redeemed.
Favored in that?
Is it
like a toss-up?
I think it's a toss-up.
Wow.
I think it's a toss-up.
I didn't realize.
All right, so last week I heard an interesting interview on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Right. And it was with a writer named Ron Powers talking about his latest book.
Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. The book is called No One Cares About Crazy People. It's by Ron Powers, and it's about his experience with his two sons who suffer from schizophrenia.
It was a gripping interview.
It was a gripping interview. Yeah. And just to set the stage, they're actually a very interesting book review in the Wall Street Journal this week, which is extremely positive about the book. And just what the reviewer says is that he really credits Powers, who is a guy who apparently is very credited. He has a Pulitzer Prize. He's a substantial producer in the industry. And the way he writes the book, he begins it by saying that his older son committed suicide. He hung himself in the basement, and he said...
He found him down there.
And he doesn't mince any words. He gets right to it on page one of the story because he says he doesn't want to, you know, use this as a storytelling technique. He wants the reader to know right away. And it's off-putting, perhaps, to many readers, but he encourages people to stay with it because what unfolds is one of the most engrossing accounts of raising a family I've ever read. One in which Mr. Powers makes universal his themes of parental love and bewilderment. And that story becomes one of a son who is gifted musically and excels in music and has a normal childhood. And apparently there's a recounting of many wonderful, what I'll call normal moments of childhood. But then what happens is that behavior starts to change. Clearly he has a problem. Medications are tried, there's hospitalizations. But Kevin, this is the older son, reaches a point, and he's over 18 years old, when he wants no part of treatment. And again, the reviewer says, This is John Donovan in the Journal. The laws limiting involuntary treatment made it difficult to counter Kevin's preferences. Kevin had moved past his parents' help, which is one of the things that still eats at the father even now.
So it was a compelling description, the book, both of a family's journey through this, coming to grips with the diagnoses for the two sons, and also detailing to some extent the sort of history of dealing with mental illness and the limitations of it in the U.S. Right. So that was all very interesting. It sounds like a great book, fascinating book, but it was also, and I know that Armand ran into this interview a very gripping interview, and the way Terry Gross handled it, and you know, very forthrightly in saying, tell us, you know, what was it like? What did you find?
And the father, and I heard bits and pieces of the interview, but I do remember the father and his joy speaking of the surviving son and how he got back into music just recently. I believe he's like 33 years old now, and he just bought a guitar, and he hasn't played it yet, but he got it. Right. And he's just, it's like, okay, it's baby steps, and just the encouragement he had that things can be okay.
Yeah, it was a riveting interview. I mean, it just Terry Gross just didn't back down, and she kept going back and back to a lot of very sensitive, painful subjects, including tell us about finding your older son in the basement, and it, you don't hear stuff like that.
She's great,
Obviously,
but also I think Ron Powers was just composed and
forthright.
Listen, he wrote a book about it.
So. Worth downloading that interview on Fresh Air. And Ron Powers was the interviewee. And also, the book seems pretty compelling as well.
It does. Yeah.
And what was the book called? They Don't...
No One Cares About Crazy People.
No One Cares About Crazy People. Okay, and on to a somewhat lighter subject, Rome. And an article in the New York Times entitled Streetlight Fight in Rome. And it's about the streetlights. And so
there should be a fight.
Yeah. So Rome is spending approximately $52 million.
Yeah.
That would be 48 million euros.
Yeah. Okay.
If you're wondering.
I was doing that.
And yes, to change all the old lighting in the streets of Rome to new LEDs, which have a bright white look as opposed to the golden glow of the old lights. And some people are up in arms. In fact, one person describes it as the difference between a candlelit dinner versus the frozen food aisle at the grocery store.
Absolutely.
And so there are, it is, the change is meant to save Rome millions of dollars in electricity costs, plus it's more eco-friendly, the LEDs, etc., versus that warm, wonderful, romantic glow.
It comes to quality of life sometimes.
We don't know where this is going to, you know, end up. It's halfway accomplished at this point, apparently. So, but anyway, that's our food/travel porn segment for today.
And say porn?
Travel porn. Oh. Snap out of it.
I have selective hearing.
I should mention.
Armand had nodded off there.
One of the people quoted in it is Elizabeth Mincilli, who is a great writer about things Italian.
Yeah.
And she's American, but she lives in Rome. She married an Italian. And she has a great website, Elizabeth Mincilli in Rome, that I highly recommend.
Okay.
So, where are we now?
Now we're up to, we haven't covered one major sport, and that's football. And there's an interesting article about the Salt Lake Screaming Eagles. That's The Screaming Eagles, an indoor football team that is all on our radar screens. And this week they're they're on our radar screen because there's a player named
Greg. I didn't even know there was still indoor football.
Yes, there is still in, still. Yeah, well, they're still indoors, and there's still football, so there's still indoor football. But Greg Hardy is nominally what's a story about, although you'll see in a moment, not really. Greg Hardy was a high-performing defensive tackle in college and in the pros, but he's kind of a bad guy. And it's one of those stories of being accused of sexual violence, domestic abuse and that sort of thing. But his was a little more extreme than some other stories. And the resulting suspension was a little longer than the other suspensions in the NFL. So much so that only one team, America's team, was interested in signing him at the beginning of last year, the Dallas Cowboys. And he had an inglorious career with the Cowboys. A few games, trouble, didn't perform well, he got dropped. So now he's reduced to trying to make the squad on the Screaming Eagles. And what the fans in Salt Lake got the opportunity to do was vote on whether they wanted him on the team. And they voted narrowly no. 51% said no. So Greg Hardy's not on the team. So you might say, well, that's interesting that they put it to the fans, because that's kind of a touchy issue. But what's even more interesting is they put everything to the fans.
Everything in Salt Lake.
All the important decisions. They put out the name of the team, the Screaming Eagles, chosen by the fans.
Well, I mean,
There's more. The cheerleaders, how they had to choose the cheerleader. The fans voted on the cheerleaders. An important decision. There's more.
All right, I hope they're happy with
that. Yeah, I'm sure they are. But here's what's unique. They vote on the plays. The fans call the plays.
How do you do that?
They all have apps.
They have apps.
They sit there in the stands. However many fans they have, let's call 15,000, 20,000. They have their phones out. The team has the ball. Comes time to call a play. They each receive, through the app, a choice of three plays, a particular running play, a passing play, whatever it is. They press on the app. And the fans, whatever the fans vote, they run that play.
And that works in real time?
It works in real time. They run the play. They quote the fans saying, it's fantastic. It gamifies the experience. In other words, watching the sport is not enough. They got to gamify it for these fans. All and right. Now that it's gamified, it's like a computer game, like Madden.
Do they even have a coach?
They do have a coach.
I mean, but for what?
Well, you got to make sure you have 11 guys out there at the right time. There's a lot of stage
like
management.
Like a boy or something.
And somebody's got to talk to the press afterwards.
Somebody helps with the laundry, whatever he does. But the fact of the matter is the fans call the plays. So it sets up a kind of an interesting dynamic. First of all, the team loses. So we're clear on that. They don't do well. But beyond that, it's, you know, the old dynamic is a team loses and after the game, the coach is kind of giving a tough interview. And the Monday morning quarterbacks who are the fans are saying, "Joy, the coach did a lousy job. He called the wrong play." So here's the opposite. The team loses. They interview the coach. He says, "The fans are idiots."
Yeah. What do they know?
we lost the game. But it's also, you know, it's funny. The old quote, I think it was John Madden or I don't even know. Maybe it was the Phillies old coach. The quote was that, you know, if you start listening to the fans, as a coach, you start listening to the fans, soon you're sitting next to them. And
they
sort of accelerated the process here in Salt Lake.
You know, so, not to bring it back to art, but I think Polyclitus said the same thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Actually, isn't there, there's like a research submarine. I think I just heard this on NPR. And it was fun. I think it was a GoFundMe thing. So it had a lot of funding from that. And they voted on the name. And it's like Divey McDiverson. That's the name of this research submarine because people got to vote on it. It wasn't anything like Calypso or something like that. But
that's catchy.
There you go. Look,
all kidding aside, Screaming Eagles is a great name.
It is a good name.
What do you mean? It's a football team. Oh my God. All right. We only have, we have two obituaries. They're pretty short. They're notable, because the folks are kind of different. So one is a fellow named Paul Novigrad, who ran the Manhattan Livery, which was the stables they used to have in Central Park, which wealthier patrons would keep their horses.
Wealthy patrons could keep their horses there.
They had to be wealthy because it cost a lot of money.
But you could also rent horses by the hour or whatever to go for a ride.
But even that cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
But in any event, he has a lot of experiences with horses, and there is a good quote about his experience in dealing with the public. "We have all kinds," he told the Times in an interview in 1986, "from the highly skilled but humble to the bold but incompetent." If there was any confusion about whether he's referring to the horses or the riders, the sign over his desk hinted at the answer. It proclaimed in Latin, "Culpa equestribus non equus."
Very good.
Thank you very much. Loosely translated as, "It's always the rider's fault, never the horse's." Which is our motto here at Read the Paper.
Like the coach of the Screaming Eagles.
It's never the horse's fault. Exactly right. And the no fault to be spread around. The other obituary is of a person named Boris Shekman, a creative Russian teacher, who basically taught people to speak Russian, taught Americans to speak Russian. At the beginning, his focus was very much on diplomats, if not spies, who had to learn Russian.
Oh, really? Spies?
Yeah, a little bit.
How cool is that?
Well, diplomats and spies is a fine line. Yes. It is cool. Yeah. Cool is a nice word for it. And then later, as relations between the countries were enhanced, it became a matter of teaching capitalists how to do business. And one of his first insights was that you need a particular vocabulary to succeed.
In different situations.
In other words, yes. As he put it, if a guy wants to be able to talk in bed with his new Russian wife, the guy needs one vocabulary. But if he wants to deal in the Moscow oil business, the guy needs another.
Which sure, is makes sense.
Insightful. Yeah, makes sense. And they have one of his students back that up. This woman says, I came to the institute with a college Russian background, and I had been on a fishing boat. So I knew all kinds of curse words, but I couldn't really discuss arms control. So, you know, he basically made that happen. But one of his techniques was the element of surprise. I thought that sort of stood out. And here's one student again. There was the moment when Boris arrived at her home and told me to pick up the phone and call a number. The Russian lady who answered spoke not a word of English, forcing me to try with limited success to communicate in Russian. But that wasn't enough pressure. Here's another one. One time, Boris reached into his briefcase and pulled out a real pistol, pointed it at me, and started shouting in Russian, communicate or die. So, I know that...
So he was quite a character.
Armand's taken some Russian, but apparently he didn't benefit from these advanced techniques because he hasn't learned quite that much.
Duh, that's correct.
But you would benefit from this. Another insight of Mr. Shekman said that, you know... Being able to communicate in Russian depends on the principle that if you can convince Russians that you speak Russian, you'll trick yourself in the process. Yeah. That might have worked for you. Yeah. Boris was the living Vulgate, as they describe here. The ordinary good people I met with in Russia glinted with facets of Boris. And so Armand, you clearly, you'd be speaking fluent Russian by now if someone pulled a pistol
on you. If you had met Boris.
Or wet my pants.
one of those two. All right, Tamsin, you had something about painting.
Well, the style section, you know, and the weddings. And one of the latest trends in weddings apparently is to have an actual painter come to your wedding and paint you at your wedding.
Really?
And some of your guests. And this can go
Not paint you, paint a picture of you.
Paint a picture. Yeah,
okay.
Not face painting.
Yeah, okay.
At the wedding.
That could be next.
That could be next.
But instead of having like a photo booth, right? So you have an actual artist come to the wedding and sit down and, you know, craft a painting. Sometimes actually, you know, encouraging guests to put a daub in here or there so they feel as if they participated in crafting this memento of the wedding, which is, you know, usually a depiction of bride and groom, you know, in the situation. And apparently that can cost from like, I don't know, $3,000 to $5,000, depending on whom you hire. And then there are other things you could do, other versions of this, as small as a $9.99 app, where this company will take a photo of anything or anyone from your wedding and turn it into a fashion illustration or portrait digitally for just $10. Or the same company can send illustrators, fashion illustrators, to your wedding to capture, you know, individual guests in portraits. This one woman who's involved, illustrator, says, I can do a very flattering, fashionable digital sketch on my tablet of anyone at the wedding in 3 to 5 minutes. Yeah. And then it's you get a little sticker, you know, sketch of yourself and the digital version. And that costs $1,500 to $4,000. It's like setting up a photo booth, but you're setting up.
Yeah, so it's the next step up from the caricaturist.
Right. But I think, you know, pretty quick.
There's so many.
There you have it. The latest Bridezilla thing. We must have.
It's so much to choose from. I don't know which way I would go.
Keep that in mind.
Right. All right. So we wanted to close to come back
with baseball.
With baseball.
And you can never have too much baseball.
Well, we just
opening day eve.
Opening day eve. And sadly, this week, Ruben Amaro Sr. died. Ruben Amaro Sr. we featured him because he was a figure with the Phillies.
Yeah.
And in the late 50s and early 60s, he actually came up. I know that, Armand, you're familiar with him as a Philly. And, of course, his son is the general manager.
More so his son, I will say. Right. Yeah.
Armand demonstrating his youth.
Yes.
but my point is that he actually came up with the Cardinals. And he, interesting, you know, as a Latin player, things weren't necessarily spectacular when he came up in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. And he came to St. Louis, and there are stories about the fact that he came to Sportsman Park, which is where St. Louis played, and they issued him a uniform that was many, many sizes too big. He was kind of flopping around, and that's the way it was until one Stan Musial, as you'll remember, the great Stan went to the equipment guy, and he just said, get the kid a uniform.
Get him set up here.
And, and that was that. And it was people like Stan Musial who helped out, people like Ruben Amaro Sr. And he had a nice career playing, again, first with the Cardinals, then with the Phillies. Then even with the Yankees, he couldn't hit. You know, he's you know, hit like 220 or something like that. But, you know, he stayed in the game a long time. He didn't get the opportunity to manage. And, you know, he's being quoted here as saying he was too dark-skinned to get that opportunity at the time. But he became a coach. He became a scout. And he became sort of a mentor for a lot of young Phillies. And there is an interview that they quote from here in one of the Philly papers. In which Ruben Amaro Sr. says, I have a pee in the middle of my chest. I touched Richie Ashburn. I played behind Robin Roberts and Jim Bunning. I knew Steve Carlton and Mike Schmidt. I was there for the beginnings of Ryan Howard and Jimmy Rollins. I would really like very much to be buried with a Phillies uniform.
Nice. So apparently the Phillies are a great organization to play for, real family oriented. So, and that may be. I think is a testament to
that. That is reflected in that comment. So rest in peace, Ruben Amaro Sr. Best of luck to the Phillies this year.
Yes, let's go Phillies.
We will need it. And best of luck to the Mets too.
We won't need it. So thanks anyway. All right. And thanks in particular to our guest.
Armand Evers.
Thank you. And if I could just real quick wish my parents a happy, I think, 58th anniversary today.
All right.
So happy anniversary.
Me too.
Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
Thanks.
And signing off, Dan Abuhoff.
And Tamsin Granger at Dan and Tamsin.
Read the paper.
Read the paper.